It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And like we do each Monday, we slow down political news, take issues one at a time. Here's the quick order. We're starting with fresh news on the pardons, that situation. Then it's U.S. Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue's comments in Madison last week at the World Dairy Expo. After that, the special election in the 7th Congressional District. We're checking in there. We'll also look at the state Senate session that starts tomorrow. Some of the governor's cabinet, they haven't been up for a confirmation vote yet. Join in on any of this, starting with, are you a dairy farmer? What's your reaction to the U.S. Ag Secretary saying that creating bigger farms is the way to survive in the dairy industry? We're at 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross is editor of WisPolitics.com. J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
How are you doing today?
Good. Well, starting with the pardon situation, Governor Evers is issuing the state's first pardons in 9 years. That's according to the Associated Press over the weekend. What can you tell us about the people being granted requests for clemency? What do we know?
One of them is a guy who was home recently from service overseas, a Marine. He was out drinking with some friends. Kind of a dispute arose, and he punched a guy in the nose, broke his nose, and because of that, it became felonious assault or battery, something like that. Basically, had no record before that, no record after. He's been seeking a pardon so he can go do things like be a police officer. He's getting one. There are a couple of drug cases, I believe, that are part of this. I went back and looked about a month ago at the people who have been applying for pardons from Evers, and the most likely crime that I found was a drug crime. Whether it's possession with intent to deliver, manufacturing with intent to deliver, a lot of drug offenses were along those being pardoned. And I'm getting the impression that, you know, Evers is sending a message with these first pardons of one, this guy who was a former Marine, one-time mistake, paid his debt to society, let him move on. These lower-level drug offenses that are two of the other cases, kind of the same thing of like getting at this, cleaning up something that was done, you know, one-time thing. They were young, let them move on and do something else with their lives. Now, what's going to be interesting to watch is this all comes in the context of Brendan Dassey, obviously, applying for either pardon or commutation of a sentence. You know, obviously, he's from the Making Murder Netflix series.
How to Make a Murder,
the death of Teresa Halbach. Under the criteria that Governor Evers set down, you are not eligible for a pardon unless you've completed your sentence and been off of supervision for 5 years. So what might Evers do in this regard? He said he would consider it, but by the criteria set down, it doesn't qualify for receiving a pardon.
Yeah, so how does Governor Evers' approach to pardons, how is that comparing to previous governors?
Well, with Governor Walker, there was no approach. I mean, he basically didn't consider him at all. Governor Walker's philosophy was, if you issue a pardon, it undercuts the judgment of judges and juries. He wanted no part of that. The subtext of that, though, is that governors know if you issue a pardon and that person reoffends, it can come back to bite you. Scott Walker obviously had national ambitions, ran for president. He knew that if he gave out a pardon and somebody went and did something bad, that would cause him political grief. So you just guard against that by not issuing him. I mean, again, he also philosophically said he didn't agree with doing it. But so for 8 years, we had none. Governor Doyle issued pardons. It's been a long-standing tradition. It's a power that only the governor has in Wisconsin. So basically, Evers is restarting a process that's been around for decades.
We're talking with J.R. Ross. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. He joins us on the State Capitol Report. You can join in. Do you live in the 7th Congressional District, perhaps? What's it like to go without a representative in the U.S. House? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. JR, let's look at the situation from the World Dairy Expo last week and the comment made by U.S. Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue. First of all, explain to us what Perdue said while he stopped in Madison.
Basically, he said there's not much of a future in small dairy farms. He said the future is in consolidation and getting bigger, that in America you get big or get out, essentially. This was kind of an interesting approach for the Ag Secretary, considering that we are right now in Wisconsin seeing a record number of dairy farms close every year. We are seeing a movement toward consolidation. And that, you know, I talked to people last week about this comment that he made, and the point I heard was, you know, he might have a point. I mean, maybe that is really the future of the dairy industry. But remember, Wisconsin has a tradition of small family farms. When you're in a situation where those small family farms are closing, it's quite tone deaf to go send a message of, yeah, you know, tough. In particular, don't forget that Secretary Perdue was in Minnesota, I think in August, was talking to farmers about the tariffs and the impact on the ag industry. And he said he heard a joke from a Pennsylvania farmer. I think it was something along the lines of, what do you call two farmers in a basement? The answer was a wine cellar. That comment did not go over well, obviously, with the ag industry. So to be so tone deaf and not have learned your lesson from August struck some people as odd that I talked to.
Representative Travis Tranel said the get big or get out model is the reason for low prices and for oversupply. And he sent this letter to the AIC secretary. What are our lawmakers saying here?
It was pretty much bipartisan condemnation of what he had to say. Glenn Grothman, Republican congressman, normally a pretty big backer of the Trump administration, he wasn't very happy with the comments either. And, you know, in talking to folks last week, one point that was made to me was Donald Trump won Wisconsin in 2016 by around 23,000 votes. He did well in rural areas that helped fuel his victory. This is like easy campaign fodder for Democrats to go out there and send out mailers, do radio TV ads aimed at farmers saying, look, this guy says you don't matter. Get bigger, go home. It's not particularly helpful in a state that's already going to be like the eye of the storm for the presidential election to have this kind of fodder out there to kind of strike at the president's base.
Let's bring in Kevin now, joining us from Platteville. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Thank you. My comment is based on what the ag secretary said about going bigger or staying home. And it's absolutely true. If you stop to think about it, it works not only for the dairy industry, but it works for the beef industry. It works for the chicken industry. It works for the turkeys we eat, the pork we eat, the eggs that we consume. The problem with this situation of these huge conglomerate farms is when something goes bad, it goes real bad. And the concern that I understand it to be in this particular instance is the manure runoffs getting into the groundwater. So it's going to come. We all know it's going to come. We've all seen our local, our small town druggists close up and our small town grocers close up. The big box stores are always taking over. It's not something we can fight. Unfortunately, when something does go wrong, it's going to be a very big problem.
Scale is an issue here. Kevin, thanks so much. And Kevin has real concerns, JR, over scale and the impact of CAFOs, these large animal feeding operations.
Oh, that's a whole other can of worms. I mean, there are the siting issues that are going on, manure runoff, smell, as we've seen. More and more like housing loans pop up in rural areas. There's more conflict between homeowners and farmers. I mean, you know, it's just a different world. My grandfather was a dairy farmer in western Kenosha County. His father before him, and on down the line for generations, farmed in western Kenosha County. It's a different industry than it was when he was farming 50 years ago. It's just changed. The question is, how can you best, the Trump administration, how can you best address that change in a sensitive way? Senator Perdue's comments didn't really do that.
We're taking political developments one at a time with J.R. Ross as our guide. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. What kind of research do you think the state should be funding? Are you excited about the UW's Dairy Innovation Hub, or do you think other areas need more attention, more money? Join in at any point here, 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. More State Cap to come in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're doing a roundup of the latest developments in politics. Later, we'll look at the Senate session that starts tomorrow. The calendar shows appointment confirmation votes for five of the governor's agency secretaries. So how do you think the legislature should handle Evers' cabinet secretary picks? Are they slow walking the process or taking the right amount of time to approve statewide department leaders? Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross is our guide. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. J.R., let's take a look here at the special election for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District, the seat being vacated by Sean Duffy, who resigned last month. It looks like now the special election may not happen for a while. How could a new date change the situation for candidates?
Well, it's interesting. First, we have to look at a new date because Governor Evers basically kind of goofed up on a conflict between state law and federal law. And what that is state law says if you have a special election, it has to be the primary has to be 28 days before the general. So he picked these dates in January and December, a rare if not unprecedented Monday election, to get that done before the spring election we have, which is February primary and April general. Well, federal law says you have to have 45 days between a primary and general election for a federal election to get ballots overseas to military and overseas voters.
Uh-huh.
So we have to look at a new date now. And right now, it's pushing off the window. So somebody like in the 7th, Republican Tom Tiffany, Republican Jason Church, they have more time to go out there and kind of raise money and woo voters. But they also don't know what the election is going to be yet. So it's kind of hard to figure out a definite plan of when to get things done. Meanwhile, Democrats don't have a candidate announced yet. It gives them more time to figure out who might be their best candidate or somebody else to get into the race in the weeks ahead.
Well, it's also interesting who, what other races may be on the ballot might influence the voter, the type of voters that turn out?
Yeah, well, I mean, Governor Evers, when he picked the December and January dates originally, his argument was he wanted to fill as quickly as possible because of things like impeachment, the trade wars, all the stuff raging in Washington, D.C. And that's why his push was. But when I talked to people, their thought was he was trying to avoid having the special election line up with the April ballot. Why that is key is that we have the presidential primaries on the April ballot. Yes, President Trump has got a couple Republicans running against him. We don't see that as being a very spirited race just yet. But the Democrats have a wide open campaign for the nomination. So assuming that we're still going to have a contested primary for Democrats come April, that's going to boost turnout significantly. If that happens, it then helps progressives significantly in the race against conservative Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly. Oh. The idea being that if you have maximum Democratic turnout in April, that makes his life more difficult. And don't forget, Republicans toyed with the idea last year of moving the presidential primary to an entirely different date to avoid having the ballot same day as Kelly's race. That's how important the seat is. So for Evers now, the choice is he's looking at doing an April 7th special election with a primary February 4th, looking at April and May as dates for this. The going bet is that he's going to try to avoid that April date because you might impact the Supreme Court race. Now, I don't know at all what turnout was going to be like in a special election for a congressional seat. We have not had a special election for a congressional seat since 1993. Mm. But the idea is it's a Republican seat, a strongly Republican seat. And if you have that the same day as April ballot, it might help drive Republican turnout and make that Supreme Court race more competitive.
All right. So we just put a pause on that as we see what is going to untangle there. Let's look at the cabinet picks for a moment. Preston Cole is Governor Evers' pick to head the state's DNR. Legislative mm-hmm. committee has recommended him for confirmation from the full Senate. So it looks like Preston Cole is on a path, but other secretaries don't seem to be getting that confirmation and that light of day. What's going on?
Well, first, I've covered the Capitol for almost 20 years. I have never seen it take this long to confirm not just all, but any of the governor's cabinet picks. And there's several layers of this onion. The first layer is that, remember the lame duck session back in December, Republicans passed a bunch of laws to kind of restrict the powers of incoming Governor Evers and incoming Attorney General Call. That set off a kind of a contentious relationship. And quite frankly, the relationship between Governor Evers' office and Republican leaders is almost non-existent. It's quite frankly broken. So there's that standoff there. Two, out of that lame duck session, remember the Dane County ruling overturned all the actions temporarily from that extraordinary session. Evers then rescinded a bunch of the confirmations that happened and then moved to push people like PSC Commissioner Ellen Novak out of her job. Now, she was eventually restored, got back pay, but that caused added tension, and Republicans in the Senate were not happy about that. So you add in those two factors, and then thirdly, the Senate hasn't met that much this year. It's just not been a very robust schedule so far for the state Senate. We are now in, get close to the middle of October without anybody confirmed. Now on Tuesday, we're going to take up five picks. Peter Barker at Revenue, Joel Brennan Administration, Kathy Blumenfeld at Financial Institutions, Kevin Carr at Corrections, and Mary Kolar at Veterans Affairs. I talked to Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate Majority Leader, on Friday. He said his caucus was still had some questions about a few others. They were going to work through that and maybe some more come up in November. The thing to watch, though, are people like Brad Pfaff at Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, Craig Thompson at Transportation, Andrea Palm at Health Services. Various Republicans have raised concerns about their nominations on various grounds, even though all of them got through committee except for Andrea Palm unanimously, and Palm had one no vote. What's happening, though, is right now it's a 19-14 Senate Republican majority in the Senate. Scott Fitzgerald basically has a benchmark of, for anything to move in that chamber, it must have 17 GOP votes, which means that anything passes just with support of his caucus. If you put Craig Thompson on the floor of the Senate right now, he would pass. Like, people I talk to are convinced about that. But he wouldn't get 17 GOP votes necessarily, and that's what's holding up some of these nominations.
Oh. Talking with J.R. Ross, our guide on the State Capitol Report Roundup. He's editor of WispPolitics.com. You can join in 800-642-1234. Some funding for the UW system is going to pay raises in efforts to help student success, like improving graduation rates. Do you think these are the most pressing issues right now? How else could you use the money? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. JR, before we get to the UW funding, let's look at the federal court that threw out a case over the lame duck laws limiting the powers of the governor and the attorney general. What did the federal judge in this case say?
He basically said that disputes over this law belong in state court, not federal court. Even if he were to take up the merits of the case, there would be some problems. Democrats sued in federal court raising First Amendment issues over the lame duck laws. It's things like retribution for their political views. And the judge basically said it's not a very strong case. What's worthy of note is we've had four lawsuits filed over the lame duck session. One was more of a continuation of an old fight because Republicans some years ago passed restrictions on early in-person absentee voting. They were tossed out. They tried to revamp those in the extraordinary session. Federal judge, the case went back and said, okay, this still violates my old order. So set that one aside. There have been three cases about the heart of the extraordinary session actions. One, state Supreme Court has already knocked out. That was basically about whether the legislature properly met in extraordinary session in December. Court said, we are not going to dictate the legislature when it can meet. The second one was this First Amendment case in the federal courts. The third is going to be for the Supreme Court again, October 21st, oral arguments. That's more of a separation of powers issue.
Mm-hmm.
But in talking to legal experts in the state, they are betting right now that the Supreme Court is going to uphold the law. We have a 5-2 conservative majority right now. The Republicans I talked to will tell you that the court is going to hold the law because it is sound law and the legislature acted properly. Democrats will complain to you that the Supreme Court's been bought and paid for by the very groups that want to see these laws upheld, so they don't have any faith in the court. Either way, I don't talk to many people who think it's so much of a shot of those laws being overturned by the current court majority.
And very quickly, the legislature's Joint Finance Committee has approved releasing nearly $54 million in funding for the UW. What do we know about this money, where it will go?
Basically, it's incentive-based funding. So they set this money aside in the budget. It was less than half of what Governor Evers wanted to do. But the Republicans' legislature said, okay, UW, you must come back to us with a plan of how you're going to spend this money before we'll release it. So last week we had that hearing. The Regents approved in August, I think it was, the plan of how to divide up the money. Joint Finance approved the release. Basically, it's going to end up about 40% of it will go to UW-Madison, the flagship campus. It's a series of benchmarks you have to hit that Republicans are happy with about how this money would be used and how to divvy it up, and that's where it's going to go.
Well, JR, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Anytime. Have a great day.
J.R. Ross is editor of WISPolitics.com. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues as we talk with our state veterinarian. You have a line to Dr. Darlene Conkle as we talk about preventing diseases in pets and livestock, wildlife. Join in at 800-642-1234. What are your concerns that you want to address with the state veterinarian? It's a conversation with our state's chief animal health officer. It's coming up right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks so much for being here on a Monday. We're visiting with our state's chief animal health officer. Which health issues do you think Wisconsin should be working to address in pets, in livestock, wildlife? What are you concerned about? What do you think about having to test dogs that come from other states or countries? Are you concerned about untested dogs spreading diseases to other pets or even people? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Darlene Conkle is a state veterinarian for the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. She was appointed last month after serving as acting state veterinarian since June of last year. And in her previous role as assistant state veterinarian, she led Wisconsin's response to an outbreak of avian flu in 2015. Dr. Darlene Conkle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Well, let's start with efforts to fight the spread of diseases in dogs. The state already prohibits dogs from coming into Wisconsin without being cleared for rabies. What can you tell us about the two other diseases under consideration for mandatory testing? That they are brucellosis and heartworm.
Right. We did, in a proposed rule package, have requirements for testing dogs coming into the state, having a negative test for canine brucellosis and also heartworm. We did have an extended comment period for that rule. And just so you know, we did remove those provisions at this point because we had a much larger rule package going through with requirements for other livestock.
And you had a lot of comments on this.
We did. We had about 1,800 comments. So just want to say as well, the reason the additional testing requirements were proposed is because we were seeing increased numbers of comments and increased investigations due to dogs coming into the state positive for canine brucellosis, some of those dogs having been imported from out of the country and having been adopted already at the point where we realized there was a positive in Canada as part of the shipment. So we had over 30 quarantines associated with that instance. And over the past couple of years have had increasing numbers of investigations due to both canine brucellosis and heartworm. So they're very different diseases, but each of them is an important disease. Canine brucellosis has potential human health impacts as well. And, of course, heartworm is a very debilitating, sometimes fatal disease of dogs. So they are important diseases, but what we found out through our extended comment period is that there's a lot of concern, but also concern about testing and so forth. So we did elect to pull that back at this point, felt it needed further consideration.
How contagious are these diseases?
Heartworm is spread through mosquitoes. So even in Wisconsin, of course, we have a pretty hefty mosquito population. heartworms contagious between dogs. We see it more prevalent in the southern states, but we are starting to see more of it up here as well. Canine brucellosis can be spread readily between dogs. It can spread even among dogs that have been neutered or spayed. So they can transmit the disease once they are infected, even after they're neutered. So through vaginal secretions, reproductive secretions, but also urine, nasal secretions as well.
And how often are these diseases transmitted to humans? What is the connection to humans?
In canine brucellosis, there is a potential that it's a zoonotic disease, so transmissible to people. We don't have good data on that, on the incidence in people related to contact with dogs. So we just don't have that data available. We know what can happen. And in humans, the disease can be debilitating as well, causes fevers, recurrent fevers, joint issues, and it is a systemic disease as well. But we just don't have the data due to really a lack of testing.
And when you look at testing that Wisconsin is doing versus other states, how are other states approaching this when you take in dogs from other countries or other states?
Mm-hmm. Other states do have regulations as well. We did review those during the course of our rule, and they're pretty varied. Many states don't yet have regulations on the books related to canine brucellosis or heartworm with respect to importing dogs, and a handful do.
We're talking with state veterinarian Darlene Conkle at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. You can join in. What questions do you have for our state's chief animal health officer? Which health issues do you think the state should be working to address in pets, in dogs, livestock, wildlife? What are you concerned about? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Conkle, to support additional tests, the state has cited a case earlier this year that you mentioned where South Korean dogs came to Wisconsin. Two confirmed cases of brucellosis were found after the dogs were placed in the shelters and some of them were adopted. What red flags did that case cause?
Well, as I mentioned, it resulted in over 30 quarantines. And just the fact that so many dogs, as you would expect, had already been adopted out. They'd already been placed with families. These families had already formed a bond with those animals, of course. They'd become part of the family. So to learn later on that we needed to investigate these, of course, it was an emotional for the families, a lot of education and a lot of outreach. So a lot of resources from our staff, but also a lot of concern.
Yeah. The Humane Society is concerned that mandatory testing could place more burden on animal shelters in terms of, you know, who pays for this testing and how does it get done? How much does it cost? What about the cost burden?
Mm-hmm. And those were a lot of the comments that we received that were not in support of the new rule. So there is a cost to testing. For heartworm, relatively minimal, and I don't have the exact numbers for you today, sorry. For canine brucellosis, there would be a cost. Again, there's an initial screening test, and then if we do see positives on that, there's a confirmatory test that can rule it out.
The state says quarantines and cleanups were ordered for locations exposed to the brucellosis cases, and at least one dog was put down. Is the cost of proactively testing dogs, is it worthwhile if it means avoiding the cost of quarantine and cleanup later in the process?
That was our thought, you know, in additionally formulating this rule and going through the initial hearings and comment periods, that based on the increasing numbers of investigations we were seeing, that testing and ensuring that animals coming into the state were negative for the disease prior to entering seemed like the best course of action to avoid some of these other issues.
Do you see room for compromise here to address these issues of cost, these issues of process, like how do we get all of this done? How do we manage this? Do you see any potential there for compromise?
Certainly see potential for more conversation, and that's why we did pull it back out of the rule package. One, it was an extensive rule that I mentioned relates to a lot of what we do in our division with livestock and other companion animals. So we wanted to move the rest of it ahead. And just based on the numbers of comments we received, definitely feel like it merits more conversation.
Yeah.
If we're to move forward. Right now, we've pulled it back and we're moving forward with the rest of the rule package.
Well, let's move to the farm here. You led our state's response to the large avian influenza outbreak in 2015. What did you learn from that experience?
Oh, we learned quite a lot. That was our largest animal disease response that we've had in Wisconsin. We needed to depopulate over 2 million birds. In that case, we had 10 positive cases of high path avian influenza in 2015. And it was the largest animal disease response to date in the U.S. as well. It cost over $1 billion for the USDA as well. So we had prepared over the years prior to that. Avian influenza viruses circulate in wild birds, and we know they're out there. It's relatively uncommon to see the type that will mutate into a high-path version. So,
and you say high pathological?
Highly pathogenic,
highly
yes.
Pathogenic.
So highly pathogenic strains are the strains that kill birds.
Okay. And so what did we learn about our own vulnerabilities as a state in the wake of these outbreaks?
Well, we learned that we always have to keep vigilant. In some cases, such as the avian influenza viruses, they are circulating, and there's potential for one to mutate to a highly pathogenic strain. We learned, though, that we responded effectively, that our training had been effective for us. But it's a matter of resources as well. We're a relatively small division with 45 or so people in the Division of Animal Health. We requested additional resources from USDA during that outbreak. And
did they provide?
Yes, they did. Yeah, they provided us an incident management team that helped us respond. But USDA has limited resources as well. And when there are other outbreaks going on in other states throughout the country, their resources are strapped as well. So we learned that we need to really leverage our networks and continue to train together with other agencies and with our stakeholders.
So what steps has Wisconsin taken since that outbreak to prevent other outbreaks in livestock?
Well, we're working with farmers and producers all the time, and our partner agencies, our sister agencies. So we've worked hard on promoting good biosecurity and awareness of disease potential in our livestock and poultry populations. We're working to be quicker when we respond, more responsive with capabilities for depopulating animals quickly and humanely, and also disposal capabilities as well.
We're talking with Dr. Darlene Conkle, the state's chief animal health officer at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Your questions for her front and center at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Wisconsin's chief animal health officer? Are you a veterinarian or a vet tech? What problems do you often see in animals? What do you think people should know about? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the State Capitol Report in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we have Dr. Darlene Conkle with us. She was appointed last month as state veterinarian for the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and she'd been serving as acting state veterinarian for over a year. Still time for you. What questions do you have for the state's chief animal health officer? What health issues do you think the state should be addressing? What issues do you have? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to the phones now. Carrie is joining us from Cudahy. Hi, Carrie.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I have a farmer that sprays the field with some chemical that kills all the growth, And also, the previous year's corn is laying on the ground. And I wonder, how does that affect the wild population of turkeys and blue jays and birds that forage on that corn from the previous year that has now been sprayed with some chemical?
Carrie, thanks so much for the call. Dr. Kunkel, what do we know about birds and the chemicals that are sprayed on crops?
Actually, that's a little bit out of my area of expertise, not being a toxicologist, but I'd encourage, Carrie, I'd encourage you to either email us with that question, and we can certainly direct it to wildlife veterinarians with the DNR, and they might have more information for you.
Conservation, biologists, and others. Yeah, Carrie, thanks so much. Tom now in Washburn has a question. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm not sure if this is the appropriate person or not, but I used to raise hogs. We would maybe raise 200 a year, and a year or so ago, I new testing requirement came out where we had to test for a couple of animal diseases. And the requirement was that you collect a saliva sample from the animals and send it in to the lab for testing. The test was about $195, I think, and it was only good for 3 months. But the challenge was collecting the saliva sample from hogs. The methodology that was presented in a video and the site you went to learn about the process, where hogs are in confinement, where you just hang a rope in the pen and they attack it and salivate on it and then collect your sample. Well, I've raised pastured hogs, and when you hang a rope in their pen, even when they're in the pen, because they're usually on pasture, they weren't even interested because they're used to seeing more interesting things all day on their pasture. So I ended up having to run around with a modified spatula trying to collect
liters
of saliva from hogs, and you can't put your hand in their mouth or anything like that. So it was a major challenge just to collect the sample. It took me 3 hours to get 5 milliliters.
Well, Tom, thanks for that. I just want to pause here. Dr. Kunkel, what's going on with that test and the difficulty in getting that sample?
Tom's right. We did have a new rule come into place a little over a year ago now, requiring testing for hogs moving, testing for porcine epidemic diarrhea, and also porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, so PERS. You can take blood samples to test for those diseases, but the other method, as Tom's describing, is to have the pigs kind of chew on a rope, because pigs are curious animals and like to chew on things. So that was a methodology that had been used for other diseases as well. Over the last year and a half, we have learned that there's been challenges, particularly with pasture-raised pigs, because they're not that interested in chewing on the rope. Our swine program managers talked with a number of people over the past months and come up with some kind of creative ways to get those samples. So, again, Tom, I'd encourage you to either give us a call at the office or email, and I can put you in touch with our swine program manager, who might have some ideas for you, too.
So there are some other workarounds to get that saliva sample.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just some other ways to try to get them a little more interested in chewing on that rope.
Yeah, Tom, thanks so much. A year ago this month, the state started investigating this rare outbreak of bovine tuberculosis on a farm in Wanakee. What have we learned there from that investigation?
And that was different for us as well. We hadn't had a case of bovine TB in the state for a number of years. So you're right, that's about a year ago that we identified a cow that was positive from that herd. She was identified going through slaughter channels. So our slaughter inspections worked, and that cow was identified and traced back to the Dane County farm. We're about a year into it now. The procedure for eliminating TB from that herd is called a test and removal process. So every 60 days or so, a little more than 60 days, we're going through and testing all the cattle in that herd above 2 months of age. So we are well into that process right now. In total, I believe we've identified 8 positive animals, most of those during the very first test. So
so it was contained?
It's contained. The herd was quarantined immediately when we did identify the positive animal. And so far it's been going fairly well. There's a series of tests we need to go through just to look and see. We want to make sure that we're identifying any potential positives from that herd. Eventually, when we're through with that process, there'll be more spaced testing before the quarantine's released.
Before the quarantine is lifted. Mm-hmm. Talking with Dr. Darlene Conkle, she is the state's chief animal health officer at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We're talking with her on the State Capitol Report. Dr. Conkle, we've seen widespread flooding. We've seen disasters, recent tornadoes. How much responsibility do owners have to their animals in these kinds of emergencies?
Well, we realize that animals are part of the family, particularly companion animals, but also livestock and poultry. They're part of people's livelihoods and really part of the whole community. So we're encouraging everyone to think of your animals when you practice disaster planning for your family. Everybody's encouraged to have a plan, to have backup plans and contact. So have a plan for your animals as well. And that includes perhaps places you could go, either with relatives or friends that would accept your pets along with you. It includes identifying your pets, either with microchips or something else identifiable. A good practice is to take pictures of your animals with you, so that if you do become separated, it's easier to reunite you with your pet. And also to have all of your medications and vaccination records and so forth on hand and ready to go should you need to evacuate. Of course, it's a little harder to plan for large animals, for cattle and for horses. Can't pick them up in a carrier and move them to higher ground, but definitely backup sources of power. In the case of horses, training them to enter and leave a trailer well so that you can leave with them if you need to, and identifying alternative sources of feed that might be brought in if your normal sources are not available right away.
Carlton from Keeler called in to share concerns about a foreign force spreading superbugs through our pets. Are you seeing more animals coming into Wisconsin as livestock or pets than previous years in terms of superbugs?
Not seeing that so far. Okay. Again, that's a concern. I think you're mentioning the antibiotic-resistant organisms.
Yeah.
Definitely, we're aware of that. I can't really speak to any trends. Just don't have the data on that yet.
You were talking earlier about biosecurity, and how does that play out as a state veterinarian? What are you working on there?
We're just working on good communications with farmers and with companion animal owners as well. And biosecurity is just a method to keep your animals safe from disease and to keep yourself healthy as well. For human health, it can be just as simple as washing your hands often. And for animals, it's minimizing the risk of spreading diseases. So just following good practices like washing off boots and disinfecting boots after you're out in the barn with animals, having alternative coveralls and things you can change into and out of easily. Also isolating new animals that you bring into the herd, keeping vaccinations current, and keeping good records.
Well, Dr. Conkle, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dr. Darlene Conkle is Wisconsin's chief animal health officer in her position as state veterinarian for the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Just ahead, it is Mondays with Mike. You have a line to WPR's Chief Operating Officer, Michael Arnold, at 800-642-1234. What programs do you listen to? What do you not care for? Bring on your insights right after this news update. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the State Capitol Report here on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network.